I'm proud to be a Jew, but that's way too Jewish for me.
Shalom, and welcome to the Two Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning is John D. Levinson, Harvard professor and author of Inheriting Abraham, The Legacy of the Patriarch in Judaism, Christianity, and Islam. We'll also have visits from our two Jewish expert on the international scene, Tom Price, and our maven on Israel, Guy Gelbert. Please email your comments to us at twojewishradio@yahoo.com or visit us on the web at twojewishradio.com. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Two Jewish.
Shalom. It's a new secular year, which is always an exciting time at Two Jewish. Frankly, we'll use any excuse to celebrate pretty much every holiday, Jewish or otherwise, around here. But we are now entering the holiday-free period of early January and are thus forced to actually think and talk about non-festival-related matters. Fortunately, and I know this will shock you, I still have a few things that we can talk about. But first, since we are very early in the new American year, 2013, it's appropriate at the beginning of all new things, even secular things, to offer a blessing. As you probably know, in Judaism, there's a blessing for everything. This next is a Shehechianu, a prayer for beginnings, as sung by cantor Yitzchak Meir Helfgott, along with a group of popular singers blasting through a version of Meir Machtenberg's setting of the blessing for all good new things. Shehechianu v'kiyamanu v'higianu lazman hazeh. Thank you, God, for giving us life, sustaining us, and bringing us to this new year. That was, among others, cantor Yitzchak Meir Helfgott singing the Shehechianu for the new year. You know, for many Americans, this beginning period of the year is a time when we try to fulfill our New Year's resolutions, which mostly focus on losing a couple of pounds, or getting in better shape, or paying off all the bills we amassed, buying a Hanukkah presents for each other. Good goals, but perhaps this 2013 year, we might try a different approach to New Year's resolutions. You see, the last year ended in such a challenging way, with the horrible shootings at the elementary school in Newtown, Connecticut, and other shootings, that maybe we can choose to focus on some more serious and significant ways that we might reorient ourselves and our society. It has now been almost exactly 2 years since our good friend Gabby Giffords was shot at that Safeway here in Tucson, Arizona, where I live, and somehow the civility and nonviolence and respect that we hoped that awful event would catalyze simply haven't materialized in America yet. Instead, we've been shocked and horrified again and yet again by senseless acts of terrible gun violence that murdered good, normal people who were going about their ordinary lives. In the 2 years since Christina Taylor Greene, Gabe Zimmerman, Judge John Roll, Derwin Stoddard, Dot Morris, and Phyllis Schenck were murdered, and Congresswoman Gabby Giffords and Ron Barber and 12 others were shot, with all of the high-sounding words and noble sentiments and courageous bills that were introduced into legislatures at the time, we have failed really to do anything about the prevalence of semi-automatic guns, large magazines, and mentally ill people with access to both. Nor have we noticed a large outbreak of civility in our society either. Just in the 24 months since the Tucson shooting, we've instead seen a series of shocking killings all across our country. In Rochester, New York, in late December, where firefighters were baited to an arson scene and then murdered in cold blood. In Sandy Hook Elementary School in Newtown, Connecticut, of course. At a Portland, Oregon mall in December, too. at the Sikh Gurdwara in Oak Creek, Wisconsin in August, at a movie theater showing The Dark Knight Rises in Aurora, Colorado in July, and other mass murders in places you might not have heard as much about, at a spa in Wisconsin, a cafe in Seattle, a small university in Oakland, a beauty parlor in Seal Beach, California, on the streets of Grand Rapids, Michigan, in a workplace in Cupertino, California. That's just the mass shootings since January 8, 2011. Less than 2 years. And it includes only the multiple killings, not the garden variety ones in which only one, two, three, or four people were murdered. It goes without saying that all of these and many others were perpetrated with guns, primarily semi-automatic weapons capable of firing from 30 to 50 bullets without reloading. Each time, with each outrage, the public mood gets dark and becomes very committed to changing the climate that allows for such free circulation of rapid-fire, large-supply lethal weapons that can be used to murder innocent people. And each time, leaders and the general public agitate to do something about our broken mental health system. And after all is said and done, a great deal more is said than done. As a rabbi, I find it profoundly discouraging to think that we've learned nothing over these past 2 years. Judaism is founded on the concept that we can each learn and grow, that our capacity to study and teach will lead us to a higher ethical level, that terrible incidents have the capacity to transform our thinking and our actions in ways that further holiness and blessing. While we continue to preach about the sanctity of human life, and we immerse ourselves in the facts of gun violence, and we declaim and discuss the need to prevent such outrages from ever occurring again, and sharply criticize a badly underfunded mental health system that has come completely off the rails in its ability to capably and effectively keep the severely mentally ill from hurting innocent children and adults, and yet, in this most basic test, we learn again and again that our American society now seems completely unable to keep assault weapons out of the hands of the mentally disturbed. I will avoid saying much here about the role of the NRA. You know that we have lost our way when the first response after the mass murder of 6 and 7-year-old children, when the first response by the most authoritative organization in the country having anything to do with firearms is a call to introduce more guns into schools and somehow to have all of the rest of us pay fresh taxes to make that insane proposal possible. But we need to do more than blame the NRA. There are 5 million members of the NRA. That's a lot. But there are 335 million Americans, meaning the NRA speaks for about 1.2% of all Americans, a tiny minority of our country. There are more Americans who are bipolar than are members of the NRA. There are far more Americans who have Alzheimer's than there are members of the NRA. There may be some crossover in both categories, I suspect. But look, if the other 330 million Americans speak out against guns and gun violence, especially semi-automatic assault weapons and armaments, the NRA's resistance really won't matter at all. So, I need to ask, with all of this recurring violence, all the pain and trauma, is there no one who will take responsibility for devising and implementing a plan to end brutal gun episodes like the ones we have been suffering through over the past 2 years? Judaism believes that such responsibility belongs to each one of us. As Pirkei Avot, the Ethics of Our Ancestors, says, "B'makom she'ein anashim hishtadel hiyot ish," in a place where no one is being a mensch, strive to be one. That is, if nobody is taking responsibility for changing the climate of violence, you take responsibility to do so. How about if we each make that a New Year's resolution? That every one of us will work to end the epidemic of gun violence in our society by the next secular New Year. If we can do that, if we can commit to a steady, determined effort to change this insane climate of shooting violence, Then we will be able to celebrate a real New Year of blessing. By this time next year, 13 months after Newtown, 3 years after Tucson, may we be able to say we have drawn the line against firearms violence in our society. It's over, and we can again go to the market, shop at the mall, and send our little children to school without fear in our hearts. May we each make this a real resolution now, and may God help us to make the changes we need to make in our society and in our world. Well, on a much lighter note, to play us in on this fine morning of our first Two Jewish show of the brand new 2013 year, here's the lovely, slightly sad love song Liebkeit, as sung by the French Jewish Yiddish Gypsy world music band Les Yeux Noirs. You can live with no money, you can live as a thief, or even as a beggar, but you can't live without love.
Man can live ohne Groschen, ohne dire Geld. Mit gar nicht in die Taschen und frei in die Welt. Ha doch Leben ohne Liebkeit, das kann gar nicht sein. Nein, 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 das kann gar nicht sein. Mit kein Leben ohne Masel, es ist nicht a Feile. Mir kein sein a Schlemasel und treffen die Zrie. Ah, doch Leben ohne Liebkeit, das kann gar nicht sein. Nein, 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 das kann gar nicht sein. Du siehst doch, es ist Krankheit, lieb auf dem ersten Blick. Du siehst doch, es ist Schwachheit.
In this new year, may our lives be full of love. When we come back on Two Jewish, our guest, the brilliant Harvard professor John D. Levinson, will explain why Abraham is still the key to understanding the three great monotheistic religions, Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, but in different ways. Find out exactly what he means in a few moments on Two Jewish. Parents in Tucson have many choices on where to send their children to school. Consider the best. Consider Tucson Hebrew Academy. Now is the time to secure your spot for the upcoming school year. With a beautiful Foothills K-8 campus and award-winning academics, you owe it to your children to visit THA, Tucson Hebrew Academy, and see what they have to offer. Your child belongs at THA. THA delivers. Low student-teacher ratio supports successful, rigorous academics, and they don't stop there. With an emphasis on the arts, science, and music, THA students learn the Hebrew language and are taught Jewish values along with a rigorous academic curriculum. Your child deserves the best. Call 529-3888 to schedule your tour of THA. Financial aid is available. Don't wait. Space is limited. That's 529-3888 or visit www.thaaz.org.
Welcome to Two Jewish. Our guest this morning, John Levinson. He's the Albert A. List Professor of Jewish Studies at Harvard University. I'm sorry you couldn't get a job at a better school. You know, it's a... His books include Resurrection and the Restoration of Israel, The Ultimate Victory of the God of Life, which won the National Jewish Book Award, Creation and the Persistence of Evil, and most immediately, the book Inheriting Abraham, which is a fascinating examination of the Abrahamic tradition in Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, and its various interpretations. Good morning. Welcome, Dr. Levinson.
Good morning. How are you today?
I'm doing well. What prompted you? You've written extensively on a variety of biblical subjects. You teach all kinds of Jewish studies and other subjects at Harvard. What prompted you to explore Abraham in particular?
Well, I've been living with Abraham and the Bible all my life to some degree, and I thought he was a particularly useful subject to explore because he's held to be the father of both Jews and Christians, but in very different ways. And he's held to be the paradigmatic Muslim, the paradigmatic religious person, the paradigmatic righteous person, the paradigmatic monotheist by Muslims. So on the one hand, we have this figure that we all hold in common. On the other hand, we have these three very different religions, related with much overlap, but also very different. So I thought he'd be the ideal person to explore this whole question, to use when I explore this whole question of similarity and difference. Today we live in a time when people often speak about Abrahamic religions and imagine that we should all simply be faithful to our common father Abraham, and all the disagreements and differences between among these three religions would disappear. That really isn't working out too well, and I think it's a little naive about the nature of those religions and the nature of Abraham as they interpret him.
You know, as someone who's worked very extensively in interfaith work, I have to say that there are many wonderful benefits to it, but there are limitations, and many of those limitations really go back to the very beginnings, as you show in your book.
Yeah, that's right. I think the question is, what is the goal of interfaith dialogue? I'm in favor of interfaith dialogue. I've been engaged in all my adult life. On the other hand, we have to be clear what the goal is. Too often, I think the goal is just mutual affirmation. I'm okay, you're okay. Just get to the point where we take a kind of relativistic view of truth. There's no surpassing truth. There's no transcendent truth. You know, what you say is your business. What I say is my business. You say either. I say either. You say tomato. I say tomato. That's often what people want to be the end point, and that's when they think they've reached success. I have a different model. I think the interfaith dialogue should have as its goal should have knowledge as its goal, knowledge of the self and knowledge of the other. We all have gross prejudices and stereotypical views of others, of people outside our own communities. But that doesn't mean that all disagreements and negative judgments are based in stereotypes and caricatures. Some are, some aren't. So I think we need to explore other religions in order to understand our own better, to understand the contours of our own identity better, because it butts up against something different, but at the same time to be open to places where, in fact, the difference has been misunderstood, as is often the case.
A great start. We'll explore those questions and many others having to do with Abraham when we continue with our guest this morning, John Levinson, and his book, Inheriting Abraham, when we come back on Too Jewish.
Among my most pleasant, at least time-consuming duties, I have the honor of serving as president of the Kohan Memorial Foundation, which celebrates the memories of Rabbi Samuel S. and A. Irma Kohan, my own grandparents. Once a year, the foundation gives a substantial cash award to an individual for outstanding service to Klal Yisrael, the totality of the Jewish people. This service can involve any one of four different fields: unity, education and information, creative arts, or rescue. If you know of anyone who might qualify for the 2013 Kohan Award, just visit our website, www.kohanaward.com, C-O-H-O-N, and you'll find the nomination form to submit. And while you're there, you can also learn just who my own grandparents were and who participates in honoring their memory today. That's kohanaward.com, C-O-H-O-N-A-W-A-R-D. It's a good visit.
When you're looking to buy or sell your home, you probably want Tucson's best realtor on your side. That realtor is Jill Rich. As real estate values change, it's comforting to know that Jill Rich knows Tucson's real estate landscape. She follows the trends. She knows the neighborhoods. She even knows how to help you find financing. But most importantly, Jill cares. It doesn't matter if you're looking for a starter home or a castle. It's like having your bubby in the realty business. For sellers, Jill will develop a personal marketing program that'll sell your house fast. There's no one who knows Tucson real estate better. You can reach Jill Rich at Long Realty's River and Campbell office. Call 349-0174. Jill Rich, providing strong representation in a caring way. Call 349-0174.
Attention, Arizona income taxpayers. You can help send children to our community's Jewish schools without it costing you a dime by directing your tax dollars to JETCO, the Jewish Education Tax Credit Organization. Here's how. State of Arizona allows taxpayers to get a dollar-for-dollar tax credit for payments made to recognized school tuition organizations who provide scholarships for kids in kindergarten through 12th grade to go to qualified private schools. JETCO provides a quality Jewish education to children in need at Congregation Anshe Israel Kindergarten, the Tucson Jewish Community Center Kindergarten, Temple Emmanuel's Kindergarten, and the Tucson Hebrew Academy. If you pay Arizona state income tax and make your contribution to JETCO, you'll get 100% tax credit on your Arizona state income tax return. Join over 750 supporters last year who gave money to JETCO and got it all back in the form of reduced or refunded state income tax. New this year, there's an additional tax credit, the switcher credit. It increases the maximum donation you can make to JETCO to $1,003 for single filers and $2,006 for married couples filing jointly. When we fight every day for the continuity of the Jewish people, take advantage of this great opportunity. JETCO is one way to foster a Jewish identity for our community's kids. Contributions to JETCO have helped hundreds of children receive financial aid in order to get a Jewish education. Call 647-8442. Again, 647-8442, or visit JETCO on the web at www.jetco.org. Give the gift of education. If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, kvetch or akfel, please email us at twojewishradio@yahoo.com or visit our website at twojewishradio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through the website or download us from there at the Apple iTunes Store as very popular Jewish podcasts. We welcome our maven on Israel, Guy Gilbert, head of the Weintraub Israel Center. Boker Tov, Guy. Good morning.
Boker Tov, Rabbi.
And a happy secular new year. Israeli elections are coming up fast, less than 2 weeks from today. Tell us a little bit of perspective on those elections. This is the whole Knesset gets reelected every time, right?
Right. The elections are for the whole Knesset, the whole Israeli parliament. And the elections also define who will be the prime minister and who will basically be the government. So through the same elections, you get both the legislative house
and the executive branch.
And the executive, right. Exactly. The upcoming elections, I think to many, represent a shift in Israeli public attention. When we look at the parties that are running for those elections, it is very clear that most of the what is perceived as the left-wing center parties are not focused anymore on the traditional Israeli theme of the left-wing central parties, which was always the issue of the conflict with the Arab world, the conflict with non-Arab countries like Iran and the Palestinians. This year it seems the attention of the public shifted to the economical situation, to education, to social justice, to different areas. I think to much this should be granted actually to the other side, to the Palestinians mainly. I think that more than anything else, that sends a message that the Israeli public in general no longer believes that the ball is at our hand. That is, there is nothing that the public feels that we can offer that will get the other side to come to the negotiation table. And basically what we see is that most of the public is saying, you know what, we're too tired to discuss this topic all the time. We want to find ways to make our lives better, economically, educational-wise, healthcare. We are too tired to keep on having election after election focused on the debate. Should we build another settlement or should we move that settlement? Should we offer this piece of land or should we not offer that piece of land? People feel that, you know what, it doesn't matter who holds the power. The results of the peace negotiations are no longer in our hands. And they want parties that will bring a different elements of life. A big issue on the table that will come after the elections, whoever will be chosen, would be, of course, the question of the ultra-Orthodox serving in the military. That's a very big issue. Whoever will gain power at those elections will definitely need to handle that this issue, and that will be a game changer.
You know, it's fascinating because, of course, people sometimes say things and then they get elected and they do other things, even in Israel.
They're politicians.
Yes,
by
they
definition,
are.
They say some things and do different things once they're elected.
But I don't think there's much doubt, particularly on this issue of the Orthodox service in the military, that there's a very large percentage of the Israeli public would like to see the Orthodox serve, including the modern Orthodox themselves. And yet it's very unlikely to see that happen easily in view of the way the Knesset balances out.
On the other hand, I think it will need to happen. The
ultra-Orthodox
population have gone across a certain line of in size out of the general public that can no longer be ignored and referred to as, okay, let's examine them, let's give them...
Right, there's not very many of them now. It's a big percentage
they're
of the population.
Too big, and they know it, and they know that without serving in the military in Israel, you're not truly part of the society.
Thanks, guys. Should be fascinating. We'll talk next week.
Thank you.
When we come back, we'll hear from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price, and get the old Jewish joke of the week.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom, and a happy secular new year to you.
Good morning, Rabbi, and happy new year to you as well.
Egypt has been very much in the news for a couple of years now, both with their revolution overthrowing Mubarak and Mohamed Morsi helping to negotiate the recent ceasefire between Jews and Israelis and Palestinians. Egyptian Jewish community is extraordinarily ancient and was extraordinarily important and is now today extraordinarily small. Let's talk a little bit about it.
Right. And there is what scripturally is referred to as a tiny remnant or a faithful remnant. And it really is a minuscule number of people left in the very ancient and important Jewish community of Alexandria and the much less ancient Jewish community of Cairo. I mean, Cairo as a city didn't really exist until roughly the time of the Crusades. I mean, it wasn't until the high Middle Ages that Cairo was expanded and the university was founded. It was a small garrison town when the Arab Empire first expanded in the 7th and 8th centuries. It was Al-Fustat, and then it grew into Cairo in the 10th and 11th century. And since those times, the times of the Crusades, it's been one of the leading intellectual and political centers in the Arab world. It's also one of the few Arab states that really has a national identity that predates by far its identity as an Arab state. And it doesn't have the problem that many states that were carved out of the Ottoman Empire have of no real natural frontiers or history or national traditions. It has an abundance of those. And the Jewish community, of course, in Alexandria was hugely important and wealthy in the Arab world. It was sort of the New York of... I said the Arab world, I meant the ancient world, sorry. It was kind of the New York of the ancient world. In pre-Christian times, there was a hugely important Jewish community there which sought to combat anti-Semitism by publishing the first ever translation of the Hebrew Bible, also known as the Old Testament, into Greek. It's called the Septuagint, of course, and it includes several books which were later excluded from the Jewish Holy Scriptures by the rabbis in Israel. So you have this earlier version that includes several books collectively known as the Apocrypha, which are regarded as sacred scriptures by Christians, but not by Jews.
Well, semi-sacred sort of for Jews, but not sacred enough to have made it into the Tanakh.
And most of us never study them.
Of course.
But that Jewish community of Alexandria was also the scene of one of the first major pogroms in history, late in the 4th century under Constantine the Great, when all of this was part of the Byzantine Empire. The great Jewish community there was largely destroyed and never really fully bounced back. On the other hand, the Jewish community of Cairo was this repository of wonderful manuscripts and tons of Jewish history, the Cairo Geniza. And there's this wonderful recent book about how immeasurably important this discovery was. It's called Sacred Trash. I recommend it highly to your listeners. I know you've read it too, so you could chime in here.
Yeah, it's a fantastic book. And, you know, having been in Cairo in that synagogue, led a service where that Geniza was discovered in the 19th century, and having studied some of those texts, fantastic resource on understanding the Middle Ages, understanding Judaism then, the Karaite heresy, if you will, the whole struggle within what the Jewish world was going to be. Really, really interesting, very rich, and all of it very surprising. It's a great book.
Right.
And a great story. Thanks, Tom. We'll talk next week.
I look forward to it.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week, Jewish humor your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. An Arab is walking through the Sahara Desert, long way from anywhere, desperate for water, when he sees something far off in the distance. Hoping to find water, he walks towards the image, only to find Jaime sitting at a card table with a bunch of neckties laid out on it. The Arab says, "Please, I'm dying of thirst. Can I have some water?" And Jaime replies, "I don't have any water, but why don't you buy a tie? Here's one that'll go really nice with your robes." The Arab says, "I don't want a tie, I want water." "Okay," says Jaime, "don't buy a tie, but to show you what a nice guy I am, if you go over that hill there, about 4 miles, there's a nice restaurant. Walk that way, and they'll give you all the water you want." The Arab says, "Thanks," and walks off towards the hill. 3 hours later, he comes crawling back to Jaime, still sitting behind his card table. And Jaime says, "I told you about 4 miles over the hill. Couldn't you find it?" And the Arab rasps, "I found it all right, but they wouldn't let me in without a tie." That was the old Jewish joke of the week. Special feature Too Jewish just for you. You should live and be well and continue to hope that those jokes get better in this new year. And now a word of Torah. As this week's portion of Va'era begins, the Israelites are in Egyptian slavery, and the mysterious figure of Moses has returned to try to free them from bondage. In Va'era, God brings about a series of plagues that traumatize the Egyptians and bedevil the Pharaoh, king of Egypt. Blood, frogs, lice, wild beasts, boils, and cattle disease serially afflict the land and its inhabitants, or at least the non-Israelite inhabitants. In next week's portion of Bo, 4 more plagues will come, hail, locusts, and darkness, all leading to the climactic death scene of the slaying of the firstborn and the ultimate exodus, the great moment in which our ancestors are freed from slavery, the model for narratives of deliverance and emancipation ever after. These plagues are interesting in and of themselves. There are 3 sets of 3 plagues each, increasing in severity and complexity. Every one designed to prove the power of the true God and the impotence of the pagan gods of Egypt. The Nile River was a principal deity of Egypt as well as the source of its life and livelihood, and so for the first plague, God simply turns it to blood. There are frog gods in the Egyptian pantheon, and they are next turned into pests that infest homes and fields. The scarab is a sacred beetle to Egyptians, a symbol of the pharaoh's power. And insects are then used to torment the inhabitants of Egypt, and so it goes. Sacred cows get diseases. The fertility of the holy land of Egypt itself is destroyed. Finally, even the great Ra, the solar disk of the sun itself, is blotted out for days. The plagues are a statement of theology. There is only one God, and those who adhere to other gods, who use their own power to enslave others, will be overthrown with power and majesty. The arrogant will be overcome, freedom will be guaranteed, and justice through the true God will triumph. It's a message that still has resonance today. Whenever we come to believe that evil is destined to reign, that those who enslave others will rule, that those who use their control for malign purposes are destined to flourish, we should reread this plague's narrative in Exodus. For at heart, this is a universe created by God for good. When we increase justice, we are simply doing the work for which we were made. When we come back on To Jewish, our guest, John D. Levinson, will explain why our great ancestor Abraham remains a controversial figure for Jews, Christians, and Muslims, and how that shapes the benefits and limitations of interfaith work in our own world right now. Find out when we return on To Jewish.
Environmental Strategies Incorporated was established in Arizona almost 15 years ago. They're a corporation that's very unique and has distinguished itself as one of the foremost environmental remediation companies in Arizona. Environmental Strategies, Inc. is also a full-service general contractor. The fact that they have two divisions affords their clients the opportunity to work with one contractor to deal with environmental problems as well as their building and remodeling needs. Environmental Strategies clientele range from single-family homeowners to multi-million-dollar Fortune 500 companies. So, if you're in need of asbestos abatement, mold remediation, or general contracting services, call Environmental Strategies at 884-1114. And, if you wish, ask for Ken Goodman, the president. He'd be more than happy to talk with you about your project. That's Environmental Strategies, 884-1114.
We continue with our Two Jewish Update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
A disagreement over the ownership of a set of Rimonim, Torah bells from colonial times that is worth millions of dollars, has led to dueling lawsuits between leaders of the nation's first Jewish congregation and the nation's oldest synagogue. The dispute started after leaders of the nearly 250-year-old Touro Synagogue in Newport, Rhode Island, agreed to sell the decorations called Rimonim, for the Hebrew word for pomegranates, which they visually resemble, for $7.4 million to the Museum of Fine Arts in Boston. That sale is opposed by leaders of Congregation Sheirit Yisrael of New York City, which says it owns the Touro Synagogue and the Rimonim. They argue the sale violates religious practice and will remove ownership of the bells from the Jewish community. They're seeking to remove the Newport congregation from practicing at the Touro Synagogue, which was named a National Historic Site in 1946 and is visited by tens of thousands of people every year, including me at one point. Both sides have sued in federal court in Rhode Island, and Congregation Sheirit Israel has also sued in federal court in New York. U.S. District Judge William Smith in Providence, Rhode Island, held a settlement conference last week. Congregation Sheirit Israel, which overlooks Central Park on New York City's Upper West Side, was first established in 1654 by Jews of Spanish and Portuguese descent. It is the nation's oldest and first Jewish congregation. The nation's second Jewish congregation, which is also of Spanish and Portuguese Sephardic origin, was established in Newport, Rhode Island 4 years later, drawn by the religious tolerance established in that colony by its founder, Roger Williams. A century later, the Newport congregation bought land and constructed a synagogue, which was dedicated during Hanukkah, December 2nd, 1763, still a very long time ago. It was named for Isaac Touro, a Dutch Sephardic Jew who became the congregation's first spiritual leader. George Washington visited Newport in 1790, and later that year famously wrote a letter to the city's Jewish community affirming the new nation's dedication to religious tolerance and saying it gives to bigotry no sanction, to persecution no assistance. That letter is now read annually at the Touro Synagogue. By the early 1800s, however, the city's Jewish population dwindled as Newport's importance waned economically. The last regular services were stopped during the War of 1812, and the city's last Jewish residents left in 1822. In the decades to come, the Touro fell into disrepair. Some items, including Torah scrolls and possibly the finial bells, which are now in dispute, were transferred to the New York congregation. Touro's leaders claim in its lawsuits the Congregation Sheirit Israel became trustee for the Newport Synagogue. Congregation Sheirit Israel says it took ownership of the synagogue, its cemetery, Torah's Rimonim, and other objects.
Touro eventually reopened in the late 1800s. The Newport congregation later signed a lease in 1903 to rent Touro from Congregation Shiret Israel for $1 per year. The finial bells were made in the 1760s or 70s by colonial silversmith Meyer Myers, a Jewish contemporary of Paul Revere's, who operated out of New York. They are placed on the handles of a Torah scroll when it's not being used. Touro has two sets of them. Leaders of Touro in 2010 asked the auction house Christie's to find a buyer for one of its sets, said David Bizarski, former president of Touro. Their aim was to raise money to ensure that the Touro will always be maintained, have services, have a rabbi in residence, while also finding a place that will allow the public to see these beautiful bells. At the time, Boston's Museum of Fine Arts was about to open a new Art of the Americas wing, including a Newport room. The bells have been on display there since 2010, and the museum in 2011 offered to purchase the bells permanently. Our goal, said Bizarski, is to take the money, put it into a trust and endowment fund, and secure the future while having the opportunity to display the bells. We think it's part of history, a part of culture in America, and it's overwhelmingly positive. Congregation Shiret Israel does not want to see ownership transferred from the Jewish community. It may also be possible they wish to see some of that $7.5 million, of course. And Israel's military prosecutor filed an indictment last week against the head of a Palestinian terror cell who organized the bus bombing in Tel Aviv during the recent fighting. Ahmed Salah Ahmad Musa, who was 25 years old, was charged last week with murder, conspiracy to commit murder, dealing in weapons and materials for war, creating an explosive, membership in an illegal organization, and incitement. Musa recruited other Palestinians to help him plan and carry out the attack. A bomb planted on the number 142 bus in central Tel Aviv detonated November 21st during Israel's Operation Pillar of Defense as the bus drove near the Kiryah, the military headquarters for Israel. More than 20 Israeli bus passengers were injured in the attack. Musa is accused of heading the terror cell as well as making the bombs and recruiting help. It is also believed he detonated the Tel Aviv bus bomb remotely using his cell phone. He planned other attacks as well. Mohammed Mafarja, 18 years old, was charged last month with planting the bomb. His indictment says he planted the bomb on behalf of Hamas, which runs the Gaza Strip, in order to help them during the fighting. The teen has Israeli citizenship as part of a Palestinian family unification program. He worked in the city of Modin. Three other members of the terror cell, all from the West Bank, including Musa, were arrested in connection with the attack. And that's the news of Jews around the world.
We are delighted to welcome back to Two Jewish our guest this morning. Dr. John Levinson is the Albert List Professor of Jewish Studies at Harvard University. His new book is Inheriting Abraham, and it explores the Abrahamic figure in Judaism, Christianity, Islam, the similarities in the ways that we use Abraham and project perhaps our own ideas onto Abraham, and the differences that that highlights. What was the most surprising aspect of what you uncovered? You've been studying Bible forever, as you mentioned earlier. What was the most unusual aspect of exploring Abraham for you?
Well, I'm continually surprised by things I find in the Bible year after year. I certainly am humbled by the text every time I approach it. But I would say in this instance, I think there's a common view out there in the public and often held even by scholars that Judaism is ethnic, tribalistic, maybe even narrow, maybe even parochial. Its highest goal is peoplehood and the survival of peoplehood, whereas supposedly Christianity is outward directed. It's inclusive. It's universalistic. It disparages ethnicity. In fact, when you look at the figure of Abraham as he's been interpreted in Judaism and Christianity, you find that both traditions have both dimensions. Judaism has both its particularistic dimension, Abraham as the father, a particular group that's selected from all of universal humanity to be the promised nation descended from Abraham, or becoming descendants of Abraham through conversion. But Judaism also has the other dimension. Judaism has the dimension of universality, that Abraham is a man who rediscovered the oneness of God, that God transcends nature, that God is the creator, that the natural order has a cause, and its cause is is God. And so Abraham is thought of by the ancient Jews and by the rabbis as someone who had a message also to the non-Jewish world of the problems with idolatry, with materialism, with determinism, etc., which are problems that are still around today. On the other hand, Christianity also has a particularistic dimension. Apostle Paul thought that it was through faith in Jesus Christ that the Gentiles become descendants of Abraham and inherit the promise to Abraham. And the church generally has seen itself as Israel, as a new Israel. It doesn't see itself as universal humanity. Universal humanity is Adam, is Noah. Adam is a problem in traditional Christian theology. To some degree, Abraham and being engrafted into the family of Abraham, being adopted into sonship with Abraham, the sonship of Abraham, is an answer to the universal human question in Christian theology. So the truth is this stereotype breaks down. Both traditions have a universal dimension. Each also has a particular dimension. I think many Christians, especially liberal Christians, tend to miss this element of adoption of the promise to Abraham. They tend to think of Christianity as a kind of universal worldwide religion, which is what it became hundreds of years later. But they miss the fact that when the New Testament was being written, Christianity was a smaller religion than Judaism, not a larger religion. And to claim that those who are saved are those who become descendants of Abraham through faith in Jesus, that narrowed the range. That didn't widen the range. Judaism also has conversion, and conversion to Judaism also involves the notion that the convert becomes a son or daughter of Abraham. And I think that notion is very important for understanding the early Christian mission. But I find many Christians don't think in those terms. They think of Judaism as an ethnocentric phenomenon, and they think of Christianity as a universal worldwide phenomenon. And to some degree, Jews also tend to think that way, that Judaism is peoplehood is everything. Well, there's something greater than peoplehood, namely the service of God. And traditional Judaism would affirm that the service of God put some limits on what can be done in the name of peoplehood. So that I think is surprising to many of my readers. Many people have commented that having read Inheriting Abraham, they see a dimension in their own religion which they hadn't really properly appreciated earlier.
We think of Islam as being, you know, a daughter religion in some ways of both Judaism and Christianity.
Right.
Its connection to Abraham is through Ishmael, at least that's sort of the official Islamic connection. Ishmael, the eldest son of Abraham, the one who doesn't inherit when Isaac does. Can you talk a little bit about that relationship and how that's played out in your book?
Well, in the Bible, in the Jewish Torah, in the Christian Old Testament, Abraham actually by the time he dies, has a total of 8 sons.
Right.
But the two on whom the text concentrates are Ishmael and Isaac. Ishmael, according to the Torah, which is an important qualification I'll get to in a minute, according to the Torah, Ishmael is born through surrogate motherhood when Abraham's wife, named at that point Sarai, is barren, infertile, cannot have children. So she substitutes her Egyptian slave woman, who will be the surrogate mother, though probably in some legal sense, Sarai will then be considered the mother.
Right, so that's Hagar, of course.
To the Amazia, they're first called Abram and Sarai, and then the names are changed to Abraham and Sarah. And when the names are changed to Abraham and Sarah, we discover that, in fact, she is, although very aged, having been infertile all her life and aged to boot, she's actually going to give birth to this promised son after all. And according to the biblical text, she does so at the age of 90. And that is the son that the Bible is explicit is the promised son, in the sense that he inherits the covenant, which includes the promise of land. It's very clear in Genesis 17 that the covenant is only with Isaac, not with Ishmael. But Ishmael inherits a lot of the promised Abraham as well. And he, in fact, will become the father of a 12-tribe league. He will become a great nation. Ishmael in Genesis 17 is not disowned. He is a descendant of Abraham, but the promised line descends through Isaac. Just in Isaac's, just in the next generation, the promised line descends through Jacob, Isaac's second son, not through Esau, the firstborn of the twins. So it's not just a question of who descends from Abraham. There's a religious element or an element of election or chosenness, even among brothers who have the same father. So what I've been talking about so far is the Jewish and the Christian Bible, the Jewish Bible, the Christian Old Testament. And this idea is reiterated, by the way, in the New Testament. Paul himself has a kind of Isaac-Ishmael duality and dichotomy, and reaffirms the precedence of Ishmael, of Isaac over Ishmael. When you get to the Quran is the Muslim scripture. It doesn't regard the Jewish Old Testament and the Christian New Testament as the highest revelation. In fact, there's a strong tendency in Islam to say that Jews and Christians have actually falsified the original scripture. And in the Muslim scripture, there's no real preference or precedence of one son over the other. You can't, whereas the Bible speaks of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, the Quran will sometimes speak of Abraham, Ishmael, Isaac, and Jacob. And you really can't say whether Ishmael or Isaac is preferred in the Quran itself. So when you have this famous episode of the Akedah, the binding of Isaac, when this is narrated in the Quran, the son is never named. You don't know what son it is purely based on the Quran. And for the first 200 years or so of Islam, Muslim interpreters debated among themselves, was it Isaac or was it Ishmael? Eventually, most Muslims came to think later that it was Ishmael. And many Muslims today, in my experience, are unaware that their own tradition does have a position in it that says it was Isaac, that was one of the contested positions that was certainly represented by important authorities. So the notion of the chosen people, which in Judaism is the people Israel, the Jewish people, which in Christianity is the church, that's something you don't see in Islam. The notion that you are descended from the chosen son rather than the unchosen son, that is not the Quranic view on those matters. So you have to be careful when you talk about comparing these different religions. You have to remember that they have different scriptures. They don't all have the same book. The Quran is not an interpretation of the Old Testament. It has a lot of biblical and post-biblical Jewish material in it, a lot of Christian material in it, but it is a primary scripture in its own right, with its own message. And so Jews will say, "Well, you or Christians, you've changed what the scriptures say," and Muslims will say, "Well, you've changed what the scripture says." And one reason why they do that is they're working from a different scriptural base. Similar stories, but a different scriptural base.
So a final question, Dr. Levinson, because it's such a rich area. The great blessing given to Abraham, "V'nivrchu v'cha kol mishpachot adama," through you and your descendants will all the families of the world be blessed. Don't Judaism, Christianity, and Islam all claim sort of to be the beneficiaries of that blessing?
Yes, they all claim to be the beneficiaries of that blessing. And of course, how to interpret that blessing is a complicated question. Does it mean that through you shall all the families of the earth be blessed? Or does it mean by reference to you shall all families of the earth bless themselves, give blessings by reference to your name? In other words, may you be as blessed as Abraham. Even that's a lively argued issue in medieval Jewish interpretation, and right up into modern critical biblical scholarship that you see in universities to this day. How to interpret that verse is very contested. On the other hand, you're certainly right that all three of them do believe that they have a message that transcends their own community. Of course, to some degree or another, especially Christianity and Islam, are missionary religions, and hope that the outsiders, having heard the message, will become insiders. Judaism believes it's possible for the outsiders to hear the message, to change their lives and their beliefs and their behaviors accordingly, without necessarily converting to Judaism. You could be a righteous Gentile, a righteous outsider to the Jewish tradition, who nonetheless respects the God of Israel and the revelation to the people of Israel. And so in that sense, some Jewish thinkers have said, I think with some justice, that Christianity and Islam, for all of the problems they've posed to each other and to the Jewish people historically, are both to some degree realizations of the promise to Abraham. To some degree, whatever blessing you think Abraham may have received or should have imparted has been imparted through the growth of these two non-Jewish religions, which have spread into every corner of the world. But this doesn't obviate the fact that, you know, what they actually teach about Jews and Judaism and the land of Israel and so forth, that these can still be very complicated and difficult questions that have to be hashed out through investigation of each other's traditions and through some serious, honest, truth-telling dialogue.
I want to thank Professor John Levinson for a great visit here on Two Jewish. His book, Inheriting Abraham, from Princeton University Press, is available, Amazon and everywhere else. Thanks very much, Dr. Levinson.
Thank you very much. It was my honor.
When we come back on Two Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest get a final musical play out.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Two Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next Sunday at 9 a.m. Our guest will be author Melissa Fay Green, best known for the great nonfiction work The Temple Bombing and others. She'll be talking about her own experience with her family of 9 kids, including the 5 she and her husband adopted from Bulgaria and mostly Ethiopia. It's an amazing and delightful story. Our playout this morning comes from a beautiful Yiddish song by the great troubadour Mordechai Gebirtig, Kinderjoren, as sung by the Norwegian Jewish Yiddish singer Bente Kahan. My friends, may you be blessed with a Shavua Tov, a good week, and a week, we pray, of peace.
Eibig bleibt ihr wach in mein Sikoren, wenn ihr tracht von eier sei, wett mir also bang und leid. Oi, wie schnell bin ich schon alt geworden. Noch seh ich das Stiebel paar die Augen, wo ich bin geboren, euch gezeugen. Euch mein Wiegel seh ich dort, steht nach euch demselben Ort.